Hello and welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. I'm John Burns, and for those of us, my listeners who come from England, I'm sure you've been cooking this week. I'm delighted to say, to be honest, that I can gloat in the bad Scottish weather for a change, because it's been nothing like as hot here. So before I introduce my guest, if you have been enjoying Outdoors in Scotland, do give us a wee follow on Google or Spotify or whatever platform you choose. Really, we're all over the place these days. So it has been really hot, and I know that a lot of you who like to take to the outdoors have been suffering from the heat, and the heat's brought a lot of different challenges. So my guest today glories in the name of Moose Mutlow. Now, I decided I had to interview him. You've got to talk to somebody who's called Moose, haven't you? And Moose has spent 30 years in all kinds of mountain and outdoor environments, and is an expert in aspects of search and rescue, and is also an educator in Yosemite. So I think that's enough from me. Let's introduce Moose. Hi, Moose. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, John. It is a little toasty here in California as well. We've got days up in the 90s, and it's a bit smoky from forest fires. So I can definitely sympathize with the hot English landscape.
Yeah, well, as I think, you know, London is, there are grass fires in London taking place right now. So it's a very different world we're in these days, I'm afraid. And it doesn't seem to be a much of a better world, really. I was wondering, how did you get involved in the outdoors? Because obviously it's been a passion of yours for all your life.
I got really lucky. I lived next to a pretty big municipal park down in Birmingham called Sutton Park, which had lakes and woodland and trails. And so as a little kid, I had a lot of freedom to explore that. And then my family spent a lot of time in the outdoors. But it essentially came to a head when I got to go to a survival school up in the northwest of Scotland.
All right, well, whereabouts was that? Could I just ask you?
It's Locker Lowes, maybe it's the John Ridgway School of Adventure.
I know, yeah. Okay.
I did a couple of sessions up there when I was 16, 17, and I started to understand you could actually have a career in the outdoors.
Right.
And that helped me track into water sports and climbing and caving. Uh-huh. And it essentially became the gateway to exploring the world.
And how did you, so you're in Yosemite right now, is that right?
Yeah, I've been in Yosemite since 2003. And I was here as an education director for the largest provider of environmental education in the national parks, which is a private nonprofit called Nature Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And then I transferred after 5 years of education, in environmental education and education directing, I transferred into a project management role where I actually run a $55 million build out for the largest environmental education center that'll be in any national park in the United States.
Wow, that sounds good. I have to say that's impressive.
I feel very lucky. I mean, it's one of those things about America is there are some advantages here, particularly career-wise, where organizations have a tendency to see more what you can do as opposed to having a piece of paper. And although I've got formal education background, I'm a qualified high school science teacher and games teacher. I've got that little diploma on the side. That mm-hmm. They look a lot more, the States has, in my experience, looked a lot more at experience and what you're bringing of yourself, as opposed to necessarily having multiple years of schooling or getting three different certificates. It's advantageous.
I think that's true. That's a very different attitude to folk and to education that there is in the States. And I know there is a very, very heavy emphasis on academic qualifications if anyone wanting to work in the sort of national parks of the UK. And I think you're right. I think sometimes you need someone who's had the boots on the ground and the practical experience, really. So tell us about Yosemite. What on earth? Well, describe the place first, because I've never been there, and I'm sure a lot of my listeners haven't. So I'd be really interested to hear about it.
Well, it's arguably the world's first national park. It was founded as an act of Congress during the American Civil War to preserve the valley and the sequoia groves, which is one of the largest trees in the world. And it's had more than 100 years of preservation and conservation. And it's important to recognize that we say conservation and preservation, that's also bound on a exclusivity as well, in that there were people who lived in the valley. So there were tribes that lived in the valley that ultimately were removed. And it happens in national parks all over the world that people who've lived in harmony with the land and to a large extent have shaped it are essentially kicked out of their homes. And then we declare this thing as safe for future generations. These parks are based on, tragically, on a level of inequality. But it doesn't necessarily detract from what their value is in landscape. We just need to reinterpret that history and make sure that we have opportunities for everybody on that sort of what we would call federal lands in the United States. Everybody has equal rights.
But that's quite an amazing thing that you said there, that right in the middle of the American Civil War, when America was going through one of the bloodiest wars the first modern war essentially was the American Civil War. Right in the middle of all that bloodshed and mayhem, they took the time to actually preserve a part of their nation. Is that right?
Yeah, it was so outrageously different from a Western concept. These trees were so enormous. I mean, they're gargantuan. They defy, once you walk around a sequoia, it blows your mind at the moment. And then after you look at the photograph and you think, I can't capture this because they're so massive.
Really?
When you fly over them in a helicopter, you look at the forest and there are these giant broccoli sticks of the sequoia that stand 120 feet above the canopy that you can see from the helicopter miles and miles away because they're so enormous.
And how old are they?
Thousands of years old.
Really? I didn't know that.
1500. They're not as old. The oldest tree in the United States is called the bristlecone pine, and that lives in a very arid, high area to the east of us in the White Mountains. And those are multiple thousands of years old. In fact, they essentially cut down the oldest tree in the world to figure out how old it was and then discovered the horror that it was much older than they'd possibly anticipated. Bristlecone pine is a fascinating species.
So those are the oldest living things on Earth, really. Is that right?
Well, there's a lot of debate. I mean, there's always a new record, but for now, it's the bristlecone pine. It's arguably the oldest living thing. And then you have that sliding scale where you start to think, what about deep sea species or the Greenland shark? And there are these, we're reworking the whole way that we look at life and how long things go because we've got better sampling methods.
Right. And I mean, well, the concept of national parks in the UK and the concept of national parks in America is very, very different. Our national parks here, if you take, for example, things are changing, but if you take the Cairngorms, when they set up the Cairngorm National Park, the ideology was to preserve it as it was. And it's a green desert, or it was then. All the trees had been felled. So what was actually being preserved was a damaged landscape. There was nothing like the way it could be or should be probably or had been a few hundred years ago. Well, probably far more than that, but am I right in thinking that Yosemite is very much closer to the way it was 1,000 years ago? Is that right?
Well, I think it's closer to what it was 120-130 years ago, because in particular the park managers have now introduced prescribed burns, which is thinking about how to put fire back into a system in which fire has been suppressed for the last 100 years. And tribal groups used to burn somewhere like Yosemite Valley every year. They would leave at the end of the fall and the autumn, and they would just set the grass afire, and it would just clear out all the growth, and it would arguably improve grazing for deer, and it would improve the acorn harvest. So the landscape is wilder, mainly because it's less inhabited ultimately in the parks. So the preservation that you see is a mark of less contemporary development. So if you looked at something in the West, where the majority of national park units in the United States are collected, there are significant proportions of entire states that are federal land. And whether it's National Park, Forest Service, BLM, that's Bureau of Land Management, they might control 75% of the state of Nevada.
Right.
And so they have a high level of preservation, and they can be utilized for mining and forestry.
Yes, yes.
And other uses. But it's, you're looking at landscapes that are more in line with the way they used to be. And in some cases, there's rewilding. So in the 90s, they reintroduced wolf into Yellowstone.
Yes.
And that radically changed the elk population.
Absolutely.
It changed the riparian zone.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, yeah.
So you have more opportunity in the US because you have population is spread out more. You still have people who maybe don't like certain species coming back. But there's room to preserve in a way. Whereas Britain, hundreds of years of occupation. And I mean, the Lake District as a kid, I love the Lake District.
Yeah.
And you've got entire towns and livelihoods and seafood. You've got the shepherds working up through there. It's national parks there are inhabited.
Yes.
It's not the same emptiness that you might experience in the States.
I mean, one major difference, obviously, is that in the States, my understanding is that, as you've said, the state, if you like, the government owns huge tracts of land, whereas in Britain, our national parks are largely in private hands, and national park authorities walk a very difficult tightrope, I think, between negotiating how things are going to be done. They can't decide they can't lay down the law.
Well, the obscenity of private land ownership, particularly with the sort of landed gentry in Britain, is that people are denied essentially a national right to access their country.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one where I have optimism with Scotland moving forward, particularly if they move to any level of independence, where they can readdress that right to trespass. It's actually a right to utilize.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Now you've just ridden past on my favorite cart horse or whatever it is. So bandwagon. That's the word I'm looking for. So we won't go into that because I could spend the next several hours talking about that. But one of the things I'm interested about what you've done. Obviously, you've got a lot of in-depth knowledge about the countryside and about wild places. But you've also spent a lot of time working in search and rescue. And I think you've written two books that are related to that. One of them, When Accidents Happen, and that's about family liaison, I understand, and one called Searching. Tell us a little bit about your work developing. As I understand it, you develop training programs to help with the very difficult role of family liaison in a very sensitive situation where there has been an accident. Have I summarized that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's a good. I come from a pretty technical background, particularly in swiftwater rescue. I'm a Rescue 3 instructor, which is one of the largest providers of rescue training in the world. And I work inside the Yosemite Search and Rescue Team, which is, again, one of the busiest search and rescue teams in the national park system. But 224 missions a year and 10 to 18 fatalities a year.
Mm-hmm.
And my technical work essentially married in with my background working within communication and social type work of working with young adults and working in therapy programs that I adapted to work in what's called the family liaison officer position, which is the person who's the incident commander representative to families when we're doing a search or a recovery.
Right.
And it's actually explaining and updating and choreographing the contacts in and around the mission during either a pretty quick turnaround with a fatality on a coronary that might take a couple of hours to a mission that might start in June and finish in December as we go for multiple body recoveries on a major incident, on an accident on a river. So I wrote a book that's essentially a text for training because there wasn't anything available. It was my COVID project.
So you wrote when accidents happen. What was the kind of principal messages that you wanted to get across in that book?
It's essentially to give a layperson a roadmap of how they can be helpful when tragedy strikes and when families are in crisis trying to figure out what's going on at an accident.
Yeah.
And it wasn't meant to be the way, it's a way of doing something.
Right, right. Because obviously I was involved in mountain rescue in the Cairngorms here. And I always felt I always felt for the families of the people who were missing, because almost as if the worst thing they have to deal with is not knowing what's happened, and the torture that I think your imagination unleashes upon you, because the anxiety and the worry, and then wondering about all the different things that might have befallen someone. How do you kind of think to deal or help people in that situation?
I think it's being human and knowing when silence is really important, and it is part of that process of actually thinking through what's happening and letting people know whatever they're feeling is legitimate, because they've lost their foundation. They've had something really talk them in a different direction. And then being honest, we spend a lot of time when people have optimism and hope grounding them in reality. If you had an airplane that's crashed in the backcountry on the edge of a 5-day winter storm, and you've had to pull all your resources off the ground ahead of that storm, it's very unlikely you're going to find a survivor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we ground them and prepare them for that horror. We don't say absolutely. We go with what we know, and we don't make guesses or make wild claims that we can't honor.
So it's really go on. Sorry.
I talk a lot about being witness. I think that a lot of times in search and rescue, it's easy to know the knots, and it's easy to figure out how to do a grid search and do some map coordinates. And then when the human emotion comes into it, people run like hell because they're uncomfortable with the idea of death. They're uncomfortable with that public display. And that's actually the time we should coalesce around people and say that their grieving or their hurt is legitimate, so they don't feel isolated. Death is isolating because we don't know how to process it in a lot of our cultures. And there are other cultures that know how to create the room for that sadness to actually have some level of not solving it, but somewhere to go. And so you have this incremental point of the grieving process, not necessarily to forget or to heal, but you have a roadmap to do that. A lot of times in modern culture, mortality is scary, and people don't know what to do with it because they're uncomfortable with it themselves.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Yes. I can remember on searches that when you sort of meet up with relatives, which is, I was sort of a foot soldier really out searching, and you almost meet up with relatives accidentally, but I was never really given any sort of instruction how to deal with people. And so I'm ashamed to say that we probably avoided people if we could, because we didn't know how to deal with that, that situation.
I was just working with a search and rescue group this week, actually, and they're coming up with a little guide they're going to give everybody about trail etiquette around family members or people associated with the person who might have disappeared. And it talks about being open and clear, using certain languages and words, delegating to people in charge, and making sure you chaperone them to that person.
Right.
So that you never get this situation where somebody says, I don't know what's going on. That is often a mark of poor liaison. Not necessarily poor, but an under-resourced liaison role.
Yeah. I mean, I obviously, one of the things about a search team is, if I was designated to search a particular section, or as you say, a grid reference or whatever, I didn't really know what was going on around me. I was just doing that particular job. So if someone stopped me and said, what's happening over there? I couldn't tell you. And people found that quite odd. But actually, you know, you're focused on a task and you do that task, and there are people coordinating you, and you don't worry about what other people are doing a lot of the time, you know?
And the main job of the family liaison is to insulate the operation from the emotional load of the family and to allow the family to have a focus point of communication so their questions can be answered.
Right.
And so it's an interesting role within our system because we can afford to do it. So in federal agencies, you're paid to be on search and rescue. If I got a call right now to go out and be a family liaison to go out and do a recovery, I'm on the clock and the federal government pays for me to go out and do stuff.
Right.
Whereas as we know, the vast majority of volunteers around the world are volunteers. They're doing it on their own time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I also sort of check myself a little bit to say, well, have we adequately prepared volunteers to deal with that level of trauma and stress? And I would argue we haven't.
I don't remember ever being trained in the emotional aspect of it. You know, yeah.
And
I suppose it's, I don't know. We're going to come on to humor a bit because you mentioned laughter in the title of your second book. And I wanted to ask you about that. But one of the difficult things, there is within, I suppose, within the armed forces who deal with death, amongst rescue teams, there can be a dark humor. But my experience is that is it's a kind of safety valve. You kind of laugh at stuff a bit, probably that you shouldn't laugh at, maybe, but people do, and it's a human thing. So in your second book, you're searching, one of your, you deal with the role of laughter. And I just wanted to know what your views were about that, what your opinions were.
I mean, you end up in some ridiculous situations where it's numbing what you're dealing with because it's so absurd. And those I find funny, like you have treasure hunters who are woefully ill-prepared and go off on a desperate overnight winter trip that they should never have undertaken. And by some quirk, they manage to survive and come out of it wearing just the wrong gear and having a terrible plan. And you can laugh about it afterwards. And I think there's a place for that. Not to maybe... to be careful that you're not ridiculing people or just laughing at their inconvenience. It's the lunacy of it. And then the dark humor you talk about, I think, is a product of not knowing. It's a product of dealing with stress and trauma.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And so that's your way of blowing off. And we use something called the stress continuum in our team and in a lot of teams around the country, which is a layperson's color-coded chart. It's got four categories. It's whether you're ready or you're injured, and it lays out where you're at in terms of performance. And it was developed by the Marine Corps in the US for combat readiness, and it's got adapted for the responder community.
Right.
And it's great because it shows as you drift into that inappropriate humor and that thing that is like becoming a little bit more antisocial, you're actually at a point where you have a stress injury because you don't know how else to deal with it. And we have a roadmap to help our staff come out of that and get to a healthier place, which is getting back to what we call ready, and being in green is the color that symbolizes that.
Right.
And it's a great resource. The Responder Alliance in the US is leading the pack as far as finding ways to avoid that post-traumatic stress injury or post-traumatic stress disorder manifesting itself in emergency responders.
So is that, and is part of that humor, I suppose, finding a more appropriate humor, is that right? Am I right? I think it is. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it is. I think people are in stressful situations and their inhibitions come down because they're in this adrenaline hyper aroused state.
Yes. Yes.
And these things that normally society would say, that's a bad idea to say that, you suddenly think it's a good idea. And it's understandable, but that doesn't excuse it. And I think it's also tied into, there's a gender base around it where men have struggled to display their emotions effectively.
Yes.
And so the person making the biggest jokes the whole time is arguably the person who's got the most traumatic stress damage because they have no other outlet. And they become more outrageous as they become more damaged.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. I can remember some of the things I can still remember, some of the situations that I was in as a rescuer, which were outcomes were not positive, and those things stay with you, don't they?
They do. I mean, I I dealt with seven or eight really tough fatalities in a matter of months, and kind of went a bit off, and ended up having to take time out and do a little bit of work to figure out what was going on and get to a healthier place. And I've lost friends in emergency services who've because of the stress have taken their lives, and I've also lost friends in extreme sports. And you have this, if you're not careful, you have this backlog of tragedy that builds up and eventually breaks.
Yes. I've experienced that when we had a run of difficult situations that didn't sort of come to good conclusions. And but what saved us in a way was that things turned around, and we then started to have we did quite a few successful rescues, and that made us all feel a lot better. I mean, what are there any some of these situations that arise, particularly with the outdoors or in maybe in rescue situations, or even when you're out with just some friends and it's suddenly the excrement hits the fan, you know, things go wrong. What are there things that you would, a few ideas or tips even for suggestions about how to deal with that? Because with that kind of extremely stressful situation.
I would hope when people are out, they're building their bag of tricks through experience.
Right.
So that as you put yourself in more and more risky situations, you've actually served your apprenticeship of building the intuitive skills and capacity to deal with that. I think when it really hits the fan, just to see if it goes, you hope it will go into almost an automatic response because of that experience level.
Yes.
I think with people accelerating their apprenticeship to being able to paddle really hard water or climb really hard rock terrain or get up in the mountains with only a handful of months of real exposure, then you're relying a lot on luck and less on intuition. And so I think that that's the other piece, is to be honest with yourself prior to going into something. If it went as bad as it could go, how am I going to deal? So you don't want to be in that situation and be suddenly discover that you're absolutely not ready for this thing. Like, you don't be paddling class five water and then discover it would be really good to have a roll. You already need it. Or if you're up in the mountains and you're slopping along a trail, you discover you haven't got crampons and you really need them, but you actually don't know how to put your crampons on. That's a sign you need to go back down, not to keep pushing forward.
Yeah. Well, so what you're basically, like everything else, is preparation. I mean, I can remember, in climbing situations, I was avalanched once and all, which was my own complete incompetence. But, these things. But I can remember going into an almost robotic state where I knew what I had to do, and I would make myself tie myself into a belay, then go back and check the belay again. I knew I was stressed, so I made myself go through these processes, and that was experience, really. I couldn't have got that anywhere any other way.
Yeah, once you've got it down, route is the place at which that efficiency then heightens your chances of survival. When you have to think through everything, there's a case for that because you're a bit hypothermic and you want to make double sure.
Yes.
But if you have the muscle and the your memory is a point where you can access that on automatic, that's where you can save yourself and others. And you see it in water. If I have to think about swimming across a rapid before I do it, I'll like analyze it and do everything. And then when somebody comes by and they're catatonic in the stream and I need to go and swim after them, I had a situation where I went after somebody. I was talking to them, stuffing a rope into my bag as I swam, putting it on my life jacket, swimming after them, grabbing them, pulling them out. So all of that was automatic. I didn't have to think about any of that. But that's born on years and years of experience. And it's really good mentorship. I had phenomenal mentorship when I was starting out.
Right.
And then I had really good experience on a personal level of expeditions.
Yeah.
And then that complemented my time when I was a guide and instructor.
Yeah.
If you're just guiding and instructing, I would question whether you have the depth of experience that really makes you excellent, because it's all based in an institutional setting with institutional backup. What you really need is, as Paul Petzold said, bad experiences leading to good experience. And you do it on your time, not on a client's time.
Yes, that's right. I always say, you know, when I was in Mountain Rescue, I never ever got called out to rescue for someone who was an idiot. I just got called out to people who were less experienced than I was.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think the judgment that comes with people making elemental mistakes, they might have made a bunch of them and had a cascade effect. It's so judgmental. Judgment has already been passed. They've had an accident. We don't need to do it. We don't need to judge them. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that they understand what they did and maybe guide them if they survived to another practitioner who can give them a bit more experience or get them into an outings club where they can do it with some friends around them. But there is such a rush to judgment for inadequate preparation. And yet,
yes.
I don't know whether your introduction to climbing was anything like mine. Mine would have been a piece of hemp rope around my waist, like Gold Line. It would have been running shoes, definitely cotton. And for some reason, we always had to wear shorts. That was my introduction. Now you'd say woefully and inadequately prepared, but it was the thing that introduced me. And so we need to remember that. And you watch, I watch people all over the world where I've been, who you see a Westerner with all the gear and you see a local person with less gear, and that person is infinitely more capable all the time. You see it. And they have local knowledge and they have athleticism and they have the benefit of being immersed in that environment. Mm-hmm. Gear doesn't buy you experience. Gear buys you a nice photo opportunity and not much else.
Yeah, that's right. You can't, unfortunately, you can't walk into a climbing shop and buy experience or wrapped up in a nice plastic case.
And you can watch YouTube and you can learn some really good stuff on YouTube. I mean,
absolutely.
Something broke on my bike the other day and I figured out how to do it on YouTube. It's fantastic. But being in a whiteout situation or where the mist is descending and you've got to get that traverse of that ridge down right and you're going to rely on your compass and your wits. Nothing gets you ready for that apart from previous experience.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I think of the number of mistakes I've made, I must be really, really experienced now.
You learn in failure. You don't learn in success. I mean,
That's right. I've written quite a lot of books, a few books myself, and success is actually quite a boring story. The best stories are when it all goes pear-shaped, you know, and you're trying to get yourself out of a situation.
Well, yeah, I think about all the classics of sort of polar exploration. I was raised
absolutely.
Tales of Scott being this, you know, wondrous thing, and he wasn't. Shackleton was amazing, but
Shackleton was incredible. Yeah.
We didn't like Shackleton because he was Irish. And like there was this racism that was in there around who our models would be,
and also it was very, very much a class bias as well, wasn't it?
You know? Oh yeah, massive class bias. Massive. It was crazy, and then you have sort of these epitomes of just ruggedness, and like Joe Brown's a really good example of somebody who just went out there and did these crazy leads and but he doesn't necessarily fulfill what the narrative is because he came from a very different background.
And that's right.
He's a fantastic role model for me growing up because he just went out there and did it. I think he used to catch a train everywhere or the bus everywhere.
I think they did. Yeah.
He would pick pebbles up to use as protection, like put slings around them. And I think there's that the gentleman adventurer, who I have no interest in at all, but I really like the dirtbag adventurer, the person who's done it with nothing. And I'm much more inclined to be in awe of that than some crazy, extravagant, contrived expedition to be the first people to sit in a shoebox from John O'Groats to Land's End. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, that's great they go do, but I'm not impressed by that. But I'm impressed by everybody who does the Munros in the winter because that's a very ordinary group of people.
Yeah. That's right. I think we can all have our own adventures at our own level. But listen, we're almost out of time. So I just wanted to say, well, thanks for that. Was really fascinating. And what I'll do is I'll put links to your books on the webpage for the podcast. And actually, Moose, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on Outdoors in Scotland.
Thank you for the invitation to get out there and have an adventure.
I certainly will. Okay, you take care. Thanks very much then.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And thanks very much to Moose for coming along on the show there, giving us, I think, some really well-researched and very well-thought-out advice on coping with the sort of emotional side of disaster, which is something that we don't often talk about, being mainly macho men who don't talk about feelings, you know. It's not done, is it, really? But there you go. I think quite useful stuff. And I'll put links to Moose's books on the podcast page. And I'll also be writing a wee blog on Moose and his work in a little while. Just to let you know, a little snippet of what is coming up on Outdoors in Scotland. I'm going to go and I'm going to attempt an outdoors broadcast. I'm going to go to the home of that most notorious mountaineer, Alistair Crowley, which is, as some of you may know, on the shores of Loch Ness, not too far from where I live. And there's a very interesting project to rebuild Beleskin House, which was his home, after the disastrous fire that took place a few years ago. Alistair Crowley is known mostly, to summarize him really, as an occultist. But actually, he was also a leading mountaineer of his day and made attempts on Kanchenjunga and K2. Which I think is something that people often forget about him. So I'll be popping along to Beleskin House. With a bit of luck, we'll do a little outside broadcast from there. I do hope you've enjoyed Outdoors in Scotland. I've been John Burns, and do come again.